Hi, everyone, and welcome to the sixth episode of the Faculty of Horror. This is Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we're here. We're going to talk to you about something that I think we're pretty excited about. But first, I just want to address something because we've gotten a couple messages about it, and I don't want anyone to worry. After our last episode, which was the Buffy cast with Stuart Feedback Andrews, some people were a little worried that Andrea and I were actually fighting. I just want to clear the air and, you know, say that was all in the spirit of critique and discussion. And, you know, we can all take a gentle barb at our expense. So there's obviously no hard feelings. Right, Andrea?
No, definitely not. It's just, you know, I can't play roller derby anymore. And sometimes my aggression just has to come out. So we're good.
Totally. We're so good. And we are going to talk today about two films, one an original film and one a remake. And we kind of came onto this topic of these two films because I actually got this kind of, I guess it was deleted scenes or something. DreamWorks just sent me this VHS tape. And so I watched it and I was like, oh my God, this is perfect for the podcast. So I showed it to Andrea. And wasn't it good, Andrea?
I don't know. It made me feel kind of weird.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think I really liked it. You know, at first I thought it was kind of busted.
Maybe that could be it. But yeah, no, I'm really glad I got to show you that video, that tape. And if you haven't guessed already, today we're going to be talking about Hideo Nakata's 1998 film Ring or Ringu, followed by Gore Verbinski's 2002 film The Ring.
Coming to video and DVD, March 4th, 2003.
So to summarize, the first film, Ring or Ringu, opens with two high school students in Japan having a fun night in, teasing each other, and then one of them happens to mention they've seen this cursed videotape that the other one has just mentioned as well. So there's a phone call, they kind of tease each other, everything seems fine until it's absolutely not fine. One of them dies horribly, the one who's seen the tape, and the other one has gone crazy. We then meet Reiko Asakawa, professional television reporter, journalist, kind of briefcase lady, who is following the trend of this cursed videotape that is now slowly spreading around Japan. It's an urban legend, but now people actually seem to be dying from it. She goes to investigate her niece's death. Her niece was the young girl at the beginning. She discovers the cursed videotape at the mountain lodge where she and her friends were staying. Asakawa then watches the videotape and then falls prey to the curse herself. Through trying to solve the mystery of this tape and save herself, her ex, Ryuji, and her son, Yochi, also happen to see the tape. So now it's a race against time for this kind of fractured family to not only figure out the mystery of this videotape, but save themselves. Now, through this process, they discover this small island off the coast of Japan where a young woman who is believed to be psychic had a daughter. And in trying to prove ESP, the young daughter actually killed a member of this university lecture. We promise not to kill anyone out there today, but who knows? So this woman has gone missing, as has her child, and as Asakawa and Ryuji uncover what has happened to her, they kind of see that she is this evil, malevolent being who is now cursing people from beyond the grave. The only way to break the curse and to free yourself is to make a copy of the tape and show it to someone else, thereby creating yet another metaphorical ring in the story.
Right. So then the remake comes out 4 years later, and it's directed by Gore Verbinski, and we've got the same basic structure. The film opens up with two teenagers discussing this rumor of this video, and it turns out one of them's seen it. Her name is Katie, and she is the niece of Rachel, who is a reporter and a single mom. So after Katie's tragic, mysterious death, Rachel's sister begs her to get to the bottom of it using all her journalistic skills, and she does so. She embarks on solving the mystery. She finds the tape over in that cabin. She watches it, is cursed. Unlike the original film, she starts exhibiting symptoms immediately of being cursed. She starts having nosebleeds and visions. She reaches out to her ex, Noah, and she shows him the tape, and he becomes cursed as well. And then later on, by accident, their son winds up watching it. So Rachel is on a race against time. She's got 7 days to save her horrible excuse for a family from this curse. So her and Noah track down the origin of the story. It's a little bit different from the original. Instead of a psychic woman who had a child with these powers, we have a very lonely couple who goes and adopts this girl, and nobody knows where she came from. And she was so innately evil that the entire community, the entire island suffered for it. You know, crops failed and there was tragedy with the horses that her parents were breeding. So they took care of her, i.e. they stuck her head in a bag and threw her down a well. That's how you take care of things over on that island. Anyway, so she's cursed, and she's cursed this videotape and just wants to spread her misery around, and it won't end.
You don't want to hurt anyone.
But I do. And I'm sorry. It won't stop.
So now we're going to move into kind of a compare and contrast. It can't be helped. We're watching this movie.
No, Andrea, you've got...
What?
You've got...
What? You've got a booger?
No.
You got a bat in the cave?
No, dude, you're bleeding.
Where?
Your nose is bleeding.
Oh. Oh, shit.
It's... Oh, my... Do you want to go to the washroom?
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Okay.
Here, take this.
Okay. Oh, that's strange and unexpected.
I don't know what happened. I didn't even party last night.
Damn. Okay, well, you're okay, right?
Yeah. I'm good. Let's go on.
Okay, we're going to keep going. Okay, good. You put tissue up there. That's good.
Yeah, I think it stopped bleeding now.
So... what's obviously very interesting in a compare contrast of this nature, which we've done before, is what the filmmakers chose to keep from a remake and what they chose to change. And then there's always the question of why do you change that? Is it to make it more accessible to an American audience? Is it, you know, to make more sense of something that isn't quite explained or wouldn't make sense to a North American audience? So we're going to highlight some of these differences now. So I think one of the big things to talk about when you talk about specifically these two films is the notion of our kind of American, North American monotheism, so our primary religion being Christianity. Christianity always kind of works on that sense of good or evil, God versus the devil. And that's where I think you've seen a lot of American and North American horror films, that notion of something is just evil and it's bad and we need to take care of it. And in Japan, their main religion, even though they have several others, and it seems to be a much more accepting culture in that sense, is Shinto. And Shinto has different gods and deities and demons and all kinds of things that are involved in it. So I like to think of it less of the black and white, good versus evil, and more of a kind of gray area of, yes, there are ghosts, but they're often tragic figures. Yes, there are demons, but they sometimes do good things.
Right. Yeah, it's important to point out that Western audiences are, you know, the West is pretty uncomfortable with death. We try to remove ourselves from death as much as humanly possible. And many of the ghosts we encounter, with the exception of, I don't know, Jesus or Casper or something, are malevolent and trying to harm us. Whereas within Japanese culture, there is kind of the notion that the supernatural lives with us. And if we leave them alone and play our cards right, we'll be okay. But coexisting with the supernatural is more a part of their everyday lives than ours.
And just picking up on that note, actually, I thought it was very interesting the different ways they handle the first death in the film. One of the first big scenes in The Ring is her funeral, her wake at her parents' house after she's been buried. And there's this sense of hopelessness and that someone is gone and we will never see them again. Obviously, in Ringu, there's a very similar scene. And obviously, Tamako's parents are very upset, as you would be. But there's less of this kind of hopeless feeling and weight to it. There is a sense of, let's find out what happened to her and her spirit.
Yeah, that's very true. It's really noticeable contrast between the original and the remake, how in the original the death was kind of, it seemed to be more easily accepted. Obviously, the parents are grieving, but very accepting grieving. Like, she's gone. Who knows why? Who cares, really? What's also interesting about the original is that Reiko is already investigating the rumor prior to her niece's death, so it's not really, it doesn't seem to be quite as personal. It's not really linked to her life quite so much until the death, and then of course when she herself sees it, she's a bit more interested, and then her son sees it and it becomes desperately interested.
Yeah, I think there's so much anger surrounding Katie's death, and it's so much more horrific in a lot of senses, because in Ringu, when a character dies, there's kind of a black and white flash, and they die, and then you might see a cutaway, and it's not quite as scary. I remember when I saw The Ring in theaters, it was such an intense experience. It was one of those screenings where it was, you know, a Saturday night, it was packed, but everyone was silent, and I just felt this tension in the room, and it was pretty amazing. And that scene, very close on to the beginning of the film, when Rachel's sister is telling her, you have to go, you know, find out what happened to my daughter.
Doesn't make any sense, Rachel. I spent 4 hours on the internet, and I couldn't find one single case of a 16-year-old girl's heart just stopping. I spoke to 3 different doctors, and not one of them could tell me exactly what happened to my daughter. She was close with you.
And Aiden.
She confided in you.
Yeah, but she never said anything. Nothing that would explain what happened.
You could find out. It's what you do, isn't it? Ask questions. Rachel, please.
And that cutaway, that half-shot cutaway to her, this dead body, which is so upsetting and shocking, was, you know, it's such an interesting thing, and it would never exist, I feel like, in the universe of Ringu, but it very much exists in an American remake. Another thing that I think The Ring cribbed from its American horror tradition is the notion of the final girl. Now, in Ringu, it's very much more of a team effort between Reiko Asakawa and her ex, Ryuji. And that parallel, like, I really get the sense that Asakawa could not have done half the things she did if her ex wasn't present. Just wouldn't have made sense, because he's psychic and he was able to keep it together a lot more. She really starts falling apart about halfway through the movie.
Another interesting comparison between the relationships between Reiko and her ex and Rachel and Noah are that, you know, there's a sexual tension between Rachel and Noah that didn't exist in the original. And so that was kind of a little Americanized, let's throw that in there just to make it a little bit awe. And, you know, it's worth pointing out that the original film was definitely, it was a psychological horror film. It was very dark, dry, very little music, whereas the remake was a little bit brighter. It's still dreary, but it's an awful lot more colorful. And the remake was made with a PG rating. So it was, in addition to being palatable to a Western audience, it was also trying to be palatable to a wider audience in terms of age range. You know, this was going to be a movie that teens could go see. So that's an important difference.
I also feel like The Ring is one of those films that gets brought up time and again in discussions about ratings in horror movies, you know, because so many horror fans love gore and love all that stuff, and how they wish we had harder R's in our movies. But I feel like The Ring is one of those movies that always gets brought up of like, well, The Ring was PG-13, but it's still scary as fuck.
And, you know, it is. It is a really good movie. I hadn't seen it in a long time before we decided to do this podcast, and I rewatched it. And I was actually impressed at how well it held up. I mean, there's an element of nostalgia. For those of us who remember VHS tapes, oh, yeah, for one thing, you know, not too distant future, there are going to be audiences who watch that and they're like, what is that? That looks like a paint. You have to rewind? What is even happening? I thought the Samra effect when she crawled out of the TV still looked pretty good. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I didn't quite enjoy the original so much on the rewatch. I thought it was, frankly, pretty, I found it dry. I felt like it had all the horror element, but without the gravity of it. And with the exception of Reiko's hysteria now and then, there wasn't a whole lot of emotion. There wasn't a whole lot of pain or relief or desperation. It was just, it's very bleak.
And I agree with that. I've always kind of felt like I liked The Ring better. I've only seen Ringu maybe once and a half before. I think I started watching it and stopped and then gave it a full watch. And while I think thematically it's really interesting, it's not a film I would watch. If I was sitting down to watch a movie and just to have fun and kick back, I would watch The Ring first, because I think it is a lot more, it allows you to sit back more, just the amount of music and cuts and this and that. It really helps to engage you, whereas Ringu, you really have to project yourself, so to speak. Got to pull some Sadako out of yourself and project yourself into that movie. What I did think was interesting about Ringu was watching it, I think for the second time in this week that I watched it last night, I was kind of going along and I was like, okay, I'm with this. And I was really trying to focus and stay with it. And I wasn't scared. I felt vaguely unsettled at certain parts. But the point where Sadako crawls out of the TV and is about to attack Ryuji, she stands up and she doesn't do anything. And then it just cuts to that eyeball. And it was it's very subtle, but when you're in a movie of subtlety, that was such a huge impact. Whereas I feel like in The Ring, there are so many like creepy cuts and like fucked up things happening that when it gets to her crawling out of the TV, which looked great, but then it like closes in and you see her face. I was not a fan of that. I don't like seeing behind the mask, so to speak.
Yeah, it's true. That was definitely kind of a bummer. It's also worth mentioning that in the remake, the actual cursed video was quite a bit longer than it was in the original, and it had a lot more, I mean, there were definitely some creepy scenes just for the sake of being creepy and shocking. There was also the introduction of sound in the original. The video was largely silent, and this one you had loud, like just hums that would come in throughout it, and then there was also that kind of melody, which she kind of hears, and she starts getting that horror that, oh shit, I think my son is watching that video. What a fucking negligent parent I am. And we'll talk a little bit more about parenting a little later. But the video is different. It showed a lot more scenes, and those scenes unfolded throughout Rachel's journey to get to the bottom of things. And often they gave her huge clues that helped the plot advance. Whereas in the original, I felt like there were a lot of leaps of faith and a lot of good luck that allowed her to progress, which was a little bit maybe harder to accept.
Yeah, I felt like the remake definitely relied more on her being a journalist and using those journalist skills. Like when she goes to the farm and goes to talk to Samara's father, played by Brian Cox, and she talks about wanting to write an article.
Excuse me, Mr. Morgan. I was wondering if you'd have a moment to speak with me.
My name's Rachel Keller. I'm a writer with the Seattle PI.
You want to know about the horses?
I didn't mean to. It's just I wasn't able to find a number to reach you.
Every now and then a writer comes along. Heard about what happened. What's left to write about, though? I don't know.
In Ringu, it's very, yes, it's this, I feel like they're just kind of constantly stumbling towards it. And again, it really is her ex who takes on a lot of this mystery and like, oh, and I'm going to go look at this and just get me that correspondent in that island's number and I'll take care of it. So I feel like they really just brought the final girl to the forefront in the remake. Another interesting thing, actually, speaking from an industry standpoint, is that The Ring is one of the first horror movies that they tested the audience for, and it tested exceedingly well with women. I think they figured out that 60 to 70% of the audience was women, and who largely went through exit interviews and different kind of after film things that they were doing, figured out that they were going because they wanted to be scared. And I think that's where you kind of start to see this shift in a lot more female characters in horror movies in their late 20s through 30s. I'm thinking of movies, obviously all the other J-horror or Asian film remakes, Dark Water, Ju-on, The Eye, which I don't count because that's Jessica Alba and no one should count her. But on to things like Orphan and other movies like that where it's a mature woman dealing with issues in a really horrific manner.
That's right. And it's also a mother. Rachel's motherhood is very central to the film. And I think it's worth pointing out that in the original, her ex has some psychic abilities, which also carries the plot forward. Whereas in the remake, it is her son who has a lot of psychic abilities and is able to kind of communicate with Samara. And I feel like that's a cultural trope as well, is that, you know, women and children are kind of viewed as closer to nature and as such are kind of more susceptible to things like possession and psychic visions and stuff. So it was kind of interesting how that translated cross-culturally.
Hi, Mom.
Honey, the house you drew for me.
Uh-huh.
Where did you see it? Did you see it in your head? Is that why you drew it?
In my head?
Aiden, why did you draw that house?
She told me to.
Who?
Who told you to?
The little girl.
She talks to you?
No. She shows me things.
Does she show you the horses?
She doesn't like it in the barn. The horses keep her up at night.
So she still lives there?
No. She lives in a dark place now.
And just like in any other great American horror film, there has to be a big, bad final guy to take on the final girl. Now, as I was saying earlier, Sadako doesn't really show up as an antagonist until about two-thirds into the movie. She's not really identified. There's some kind of mystery. They're on to her story, but she doesn't really show up. Very, very early on in The Ring, Samara just starts like popping up, and we get this sense of there's this girl, she's wearing white, and there's hair in front of her face. So what they do in The Ring is really identify and single out the villain. Now, this is very common. We've talked about this in actually our first episode, so you can go back and listen to that if you missed it, about how the theorist Robin Wood talks a lot about this, is that malevolent evil figure in a horror film represents some kind of repression, some kind of evil deed, and it is often treated kind of like as a bad seed. If we single out this one thing, if we contain it, if we kill it, then we're all fine and good. So The Ring kind of problematizes this a lot, because we have Samara as this, you know, almost Freddy Krueger-like villain. She doesn't talk as much, which is good. So we have that figure, but at the end, they still haven't really figured out a way to contain her. So it has a nice play in between a final horror villain and something else. Now, in the original film, there's just this sense that there is this kind of like evil force. What they go on to explain in the sequels to Ringu, which there are two of, is that Sadako's father, her mother was a psychic, which we learn in this film, and her father is not actually the person that raised her. It was possibly a water demon. So that explains her connection to water, the sea, all this kind of stuff. I actually have a blog post that I can link that I wrote on my blog, Scare Tactic. I try to tackle different horror mysteries, and this one is called Horror Mystery, The Ring, Who is Your Daddy and What Does He Do? So I'll post that to our Twitter and Facebook so you can check that out. Sorry, I feel like I'm talking weird because I have this new lip gloss on. Did you notice?
Oh, yeah.
But nice. It's really pretty, but I feel like it makes me talk weird.
No, it doesn't.
No?
It makes your teeth look really white. Like, let's stick it.
Okay.
What do they call them? Selfies? Is that what the kids are calling them nowadays? So let's just, okay, come over here.
Okay.
Here we go.
Okay.
Smile. Let's see. Oh. Why?
What?
Okay, that didn't turn out. Let's try again.
Maybe.
The fuck is wrong with my face?
I think it's just your camera. I think you're fine. I think we should just keep going with the podcast.
Yeah, my camera was acting up a little bit last week. I don't know if you saw those Black Museum pictures I posted.
Yeah, and on Instagram.
I started to wonder if my camera was haunted. Well, I'm sure it's something wrong with my camera and not my face.
Yeah. No, your face looks fine. You look great.
Okay. Yeah, well, whatever.
Now, what struck me most strongly watching the original was that I thought the theme of the family was really pervasive, and I thought it was really interesting when I was doing some readings on this movie up till now, is that there's a lot you can talk about in this movie. There's a lot you can talk about, the compare and contrast like we're doing, or you can talk about it in itself. You can talk about, we looked at a great article on how the movie pits a fear of nature with a fear of technology against one another and how the different films tackle that. But not a lot of articles I read talked about the family unit. Now, both these movies center on very dysfunctional families, but the original, it's so much worse. The original, I couldn't help but think that this is actually an extremely negligent and borderline abusive mother. She was in no way in that movie does she ever show any affection for this child. There's no terms of endearment. There is never an embrace or so much as a pat on the head. You know, if anything, she's nagging. And he is so fiercely independent and really, really cute. He was so cute in the original,
so cute.
Eh?
I just wanted to. Oh.
Adorable little fellow. And when
a little sushi roll.
Wow. And when she finds him watching the movie, she gives him a shake so hard that I remember just seeing that little head rock on that little neck. And I was like, fuck, woman, chill out. And then, of course, the dad is completely out of the picture.
And he's kind of an asshole, too. He hits her.
Oh, yeah, he sure does. I don't really blame him, but anyway, I mean, even the title of the movie, The Ring, obviously points to, it's a strong symbol that comes up in both movies quite a bit. You know, there's Samra's view from the bottom of the well looking like a ring. There's also the circular nature of the curse, but there's the circular nature of the family as well. There's a lot of strong tree imagery, the tree representing the family. So we're going to have to talk about the ending. And about how the difference in the ending is really important. And I'll tell you that right now. Spoiler alert, yada, yada, yada. You shouldn't be listening to this if you haven't seen the movies anyway. But in the original, what we have is when they discover that the way to lift the curse is to reproduce the movie, is to copy it and show it to someone else. And that is what saved Reiko and what did not save Ryuji. So what happens is they decide that in order to save the little boy, they're going to show the video to their grandfather. And they've kind of singled him out as, you know, there's a phone call where she says, you've got to do us a favor. Yeah. It's really important. Yeah. You know, you're kind of taking one for the team here. And he's old, right? What do old people have to offer the universe anyway?
And his their kid was bored there. Probably like the worst grandparent ever. Shook Reiko really hard when she was a kid.
Seriously, the grandfather just took him fishing. Like, that's the worst.
Yeah, and this like beautiful stream.
So anyway, they've identified who their next victim is, and there's a sense that the curse will be broken because it will end with the noble sacrifice of the grandfather. Mm-hmm. Whereupon in the remake, they're aware that they have to show it to someone else, and the film actually ends with the little boy saying, what's it gonna be? And Rachel just kind of looking like, fuck, I don't know.
It's going to keep going, isn't it? She'll never stop.
Don't worry, sweetie. You're gonna be okay.
What about the person we show it to? What happens to them?
And I thought that was really poignant that they identified a family member in the original when it's such a fractured family. I feel like what came through strongly in the original was that your family sucks. They suck at being family members. But when the chips are really down, they are the ones you can count on to make the ultimate sacrifice. And as negligent a father as both Noah and Ryuji were, I think there's even a scene in the remake where Noah runs into his son, Aiden, on the street in the rain.
That's actually duplicated from the first film.
Okay, so it's in both of them. And it's the most awkward thing ever. They just kind of see each other and they're like, ugh, weird, and walk away, like not even acknowledging. And yet when it comes down to our son has seen the video, then these men decide to be dads in the most basic sense.
There are actually two scenes I want to touch on to kind of look at closely from both films. Those are the scenes, well, the first one is when Reiko has her kind of breakdown of like, if I die, you have to try to save our son. Please promise me you're going to try to save our son. Now, in the original Japanese version, Ryuji is very like, maybe we should all die, woman. Maybe this should all just stop with us. And it's very practical, it's very cold, it's very mean. It's a very odd scene to watch as the watcher of many North American films. You know, there wasn't that hero's rallying call. There was this sense of this kind of desolate, you know, descent into madness almost. Now, Rachel in the remake has very, very similar lines to this, where she asks Noah to look after Aiden and just try to figure it out if something happens to her. And Noah keeps saying, we're going to figure this out. We're going to make it through. We are going to save us. And we're going to save our son. And then he starts being a man, which means breaking everything, which leads to all the these marbles forming an arrow on the goddamn floor. Like, I think this was the point where the screenwriter and the director were like, okay, we need to hurry this up. So they're
forming an arrow.
Yeah, the marbles form an arrow on the floor.
I thought they just kind of gathered to where the ring was because it was like, that's where the floor was weird because it was like burned underneath.
See, that would make sense. No, no, there is a literal arrow. Oh.
My mind made sense of it and convinced me otherwise.
Well, your mind does one thing. Yeah, no, I think it would have made sense if they'd all just drawn to the middle, but no, it is an arrow which technically would be pointing to a wall. But they pull off the carpet and they see the ring on the floor that's kind of like mildew. Now, in the original Japanese film, there's a bit of a break in between the two where that happens on the island. They have to journey back to the mainland and figure out everything. Now, what they figure out is that Sadako is in that well in the original cabin. They drive there. They understand, like, the only thing we can think of doing is, you know, getting her bones, because she's probably still there, and putting them to rest, settling her spirit, and hopefully that will help the spirit rest, and that will free us from the curse. So that's what they go do. They apparently do a hardware store stop. You know, they get ropes and buckets, and they're just trying to lift all the water out. And eventually, Ryuji is the first one pulling water out, and Reiko has to pull them all out. And it's this long, drawn-out scene, and it's tiring and it's exhausting, and Reiko whines a lot in it. Conversely, what happens is after the marbles form on the floor, they pull off the carpet, Noah rips up the floor, and they just kind of stand there looking at this well going, oh my God, there's a well here. What now? And we slowly see screws turning. They push off the lid, and then from out of nowhere almost, the screws have turned, part of the floor breaks, and a TV literally falls on Rachel, pushing her into the well.
Right, and so that's important because that's a little indication of Samra wanting to be found and kind of helping their mission along. Is like, here I am, come on down, you're not going to find me from up there.
And I think that actually speaks to the sense that Ringu takes place in a much larger world, that this video was already spreading. There was something already going on with this video. And then in the remake, it's a lot more, for lack of a better term, kind of self-centered and self-involved with these characters. Samara needed Rachel to find her and free her. I still remember when I first saw this film and that moment when, because I was a little like, oh shit, if it ends with her being a free spirit. And I was like, okay, this has still been a pretty great movie. And when her son Aiden says, why did you let her out? And my stomach just like fell through the floor and I was so fucking scared.
What happened to the girl?
Samara?
Is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
Is she still in the dark place?
No. We set her free.
You helped her?
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
What's wrong, honey?
You weren't supposed to help her.
It's okay now. She's not gonna hurt you. She...
Don't you understand, Rachel? She never sleeps.
Right, but the bummer with that part is, why did you let her out? And then we're like, oh God, we shouldn't have let her out. Why, Aiden? Why is that? What do you know? Is something worse than the imminent death that we were already expecting going to happen? And the answer is kind of no. So I actually found that a little, I mean, his nose bleeds at the moment. And then we kind of realize that, oh, the curse wasn't lifted, as if that was the worst case scenario. But again, Aiden's extrasensory connection to Samra was something that I could actually largely do without in the remake. It didn't bother me to the point of hatred or anything, but it's something I could have done without. And I felt actually the same way about Samra's father's suicide. Yeah. Is it was almost campy.
Yeah.
Whereas the rest of the movie
was not.
Yeah, there's nothing more subtle than killing yourself by pushing a TV into like the water and electrocuting yourself. One of the interesting things about Ringu, obviously it's based on a novel by Koji Suzuki. Now, Ring is a much, much different story. One of the protagonists is a self-admitted rapist. It follows kind of the same structure, but it's a much different kind of tone and sense. Now, that novel was actually based on a famous kabuki folklore story called Bansho Sarayashiki. Now, this was a kabuki play, which was kind of also later turned into Ghosts of Yochiya, which is a 1959 Japanese kind of haunted house thriller. A lot of people compare it to The Haunting. Now, so this is kind of a ghost story. It's a woman seeking vengeance. So it's incredibly famous. It's been around in Japanese culture since the 1600s. And just in Japanese folklore and in all the various religions, there are several interesting female kind of deities and demons, which Sadako and then Samara are based on. So one of the first ones is Hanya, a female demon who is just part of Japanese folklore. Oiwa, who is a murdered woman seeking vengeance from beyond the grave. Generally, she tends to involve being betrayed by a lover of some kind. And then I think our favorite, Okiku, girl drowned in well who then haunts it.
That sounds familiar.
Vaguely. And I like that she has the cutest name.
It is pretty cute.
I wonder what she looked like.
Oh, I have, I've got this book on Japanese folklore. I've had this open on my lap. It's right.
Oh my God, this is so convenient.
Yeah, right there.
What?
Oh.
I can't see her face, Andrea. You scribbled over it. Why would you do that?
Why? I just had a pen in my hand. Oh, shit, this was a library book.
So basically, there is a huge tradition of Japanese women and their demon counterparts being part of folklore and history. There's also another really interesting kind of historical reference, which I thought really segued into The Ring quite interestingly. So during a feudal Japan era, if anyone remembers those days, it was often the men who would wear their hair long and down. And women would have long hair, but always wear it up. And it was very apparently well kept, very clean, very neat. So when a woman, for whatever reason during this time, would have her hair down and if it appeared to be wild, this would actually be quite terrifying because it was a sign that she was unhinged and mentally unwell. And so it's a very interesting thing to see from feudal Japan hundreds of years ago. We kind of have this identity with this woman whose face we can't see and there's something not right about it. Another thing I wanted to talk about historically was the connection between a public tragedy and these films. Now, in 1995, Tokyo, there was a sarin gas attack in the subway. It killed several people and was a pretty harrowing event. Again, this was kind of before a lot of bioterrorism was happening, before SARS, before all of these kind of things, before the repopularization of the zombie plague idea. So this is quite new, and it was really scary. And then from there, in Japanese culture, novels, movies, plays, TV shows, there was a real rise in the concern about bioterrorism and a viral plague. So a few, like 3 years later, Ring pops up. And the novel actually came up before, obviously. So we have that, then into the movie. And there's a real sense of this kind of paranoia and suspicion about what this thing is and when it's going to find you. Now, The Ring came out in 2002, and obviously the year before was September 11th. So we still get that sense of the paranoid fantasies and the worry about something kind of unknown and ungrasped rising from within and being able to attack us at our most vulnerable points.
Right, and it's important to remember that Japan is extremely densely populated, and also culturally, there's a thing with fads in Japan. You know, like something hits and it spreads like wildfire and it's the only thing everyone's talking about for a while and then it, you know, it tends to die down.
Well, and it's also, for those of you that don't know, it's an island. So that kind of all the talk of gods and water and brine and ghouls, it makes a lot of sense because it has a lot of relevancy to them. You know, similarly to a place like England, you're not very far away from water or the ocean at any time. In America, in North America, it's just this huge block of land, you know, so we don't have that same connection to the water. So I thought it was interesting that their choice was to set it in Seattle, which I guess is cold and rainy and right by the sea. So it's the Vancouver of the States.
Now, a popular critique of the remake is that it does tend to over-explain and over-embellish a lot of things. And to a certain extent, I feel like it's okay, because I feel like some of the explanations were actually kind of neat. Like, how long could someone survive down in a well? Well, 7 days. I thought that was a nice little tie-in, you know, that didn't actually hurt anything. I felt like it went over the top. They did tend to over-explain here and there. We did see too much of Samara throughout the film. The footage of her crazy person tapes I could have done without, quite frankly. So there is an element of over-explaining.
Samara, how did you make these pictures?
I don't make them. I see them. And then they just are.
I think there's a sense that they were worried about the illogical aspects of this film not playing to an audience, whereas Japanese culture apparently and seemingly it's a lot more accepting, and they are just seem to be like, yeah, there's a ghost and we're cursed. Let's go. Let's rent a car. Yeah. Let's spend the weekend together. We'll figure it out. Maybe you'll hit me. Who knows? Yeah. And then in this, it seems like by the time I remember watching it again, when Naomi Watts goes to see Katie's friend who was with her when she dies and try to figure out what happened to her, and her friend shows her, like, pulls her fingers down and she says, you have 4 more days. I was like, what have you been doing with 3 days? Mm-hmm. Taking selfies and getting nosebleeds? That's stupid.
Definitely not parenting, that's for sure.
No.
Should we read something?
I'm kind of tired.
Okay. Sweet dreams.
Now, I've always loved Japanese films. I remember on Saturday nights, there was a local channel that would always show Chinese films, actually. It was kind of Cantonese, and I used to love them, and my parents found it so weird that I loved them, but it's like, you know, like budding sociologist in training, I found them culturally so interesting. And I remember I'd watch them, and the translations wouldn't always make sense, and there'd always be some kind of like nonsense humor that I couldn't really get. But I remember one time I was watching one, and I was like, I feel like I've seen this before. What is this story? Oh, this is Son-in-Law. I have seen this before, minus the Pauly Shore, you know, and I don't know which came first. We can't say that The Ring was among the first remakes of Asian movies, that's for sure. But some of my favorite Asian horror movies are the most nonsensical but visually engrossing things that you've ever seen. And a great example is House and Suicide Club. And those are actually two films that I reviewed for the Rue Morgue Top 200 alternative films you must see supplement. And, you know, as much as you love them, when you're actually tasked with the challenge of describing them and describe why you love them, they don't make a whole lot of sense, but they're really visually compelling, and there's music and there's action and there's a lot of color and stuff going on. I found a lot of that absent from the original. So, you know, this is actually one of those few instances where I have to say I prefer the remake.
どなすか。見知らぬ黄色い犬が僕らの中を咲いていつも笑う。 Because death, it's a shine on our own.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting watching it because everything in that movie seems to go through the blue lens filter in Gore Verbinski's camera. But I do have to say, this was 2002, so that's, what, a year or two before the first Saw came out? I think the first Saw was 2004, so it was less of that, you know, Wesley from The Princess Bride not looking so hot. And it was this kind of really interesting filter. And then watching it again, it was I was expecting it. And I noticed that the only time the tone of the filter changed was when Samara was about to attack. So when Aiden's ripping up the floorboards in the cabin, the tones start to be actually become a lot warmer because they're being filtered through the sun behind the trees and the red leaves. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we should talk a little bit about some of these similarities.
Yeah.
And I think there are things that speak to an American audience and things that speak to a Japanese audience. Now, a lot of the Japanese filmmakers that have been creating contemporary horror have been greatly influenced by American films. You know, Evil Dead, The Haunting, all of these films have had a huge impact on them, and they've readily admitted it, taken it as part of their own kind of culture and psyche, and then reinterpreted them and refiltered them, which is amazing, and part of one of the reasons why we should all watch more horror movies. So now we're actually going to talk about some of the similarities between the two, because they are different yet the same. This will hopefully make sense once I talk you through a few of them. So both films share ghost girls, dark water, viral curses, disrupted families, self-referentiality, threatening phone calls, and dead teenagers. Urban legends is also a huge factor in both. Now, I think it's interesting because things like dead teenagers, threatening phone calls, those are pretty, and especially self-referentiality, those are all very American traits I tend to associate.
Yes, very much like classic slasher horror elements in that first scene.
And they kind of mimic them fairly similarly in both films, but in the Japanese film, they're like in sweatshirts and jeans, and in the American, they're in like Catholic schoolgirl uniforms.
Right. Well, that's all they're allowed to wear, right?
Well, that's what you're wearing right now, and you graduated. How long? They wouldn't let you take it off, would they?
I didn't want to. No, but seriously, in Japan, if you're a student, you have to wear the uniform of a student at all times to be identified as student age and therefore not to be drinking or smoking or anything like that. Another thing that that both films share as almost a classic horror trope is, you know, the girl who gets killed is the one who snuck off to a cabin to be with her boyfriend. So there is an element of kind of punishment.
So, did you guys, you know, do anything?
Like what?
Oh my god, you totally did! You were home! Tell me now! No.
Rachel, on the other hand, is punished for having stuck her nose in where it doesn't belong, and then again when her son watches it.
Which I assume stems from her not being married when she had a child.
What a slut.
Whore. So I think it's interesting because both of these, they deal with these kind of really esoteric and high concept notions of horror and the way monsters and different things can get at us. But in the sense, as Andrea was just saying, they all have to do with this disrupted, corrupted family unit. So actually part of my question to Andrea, which she doesn't know yet, so I'm springing it on you. Does this film reinforce some kind of notion of Puritan values? Because I was thinking about this last night, making notes, watching the movies again, and part of me thinks that it must at some point. You know, Samara and Sadako come from disrupted families, from being almost a bastard child and an unwanted child, and then it feeds into this family, and just as it's about to bring them together, it kills, you know, the father figure.
The remake is so very sympathetic to Rachel. It's sympathetic to her plight and her pain and her mission throughout. And it's even a bit more sympathetic to her bad parenting. I feel like she shows a bit more remorse about it than Reiko does. I guess it really boils down to the real family dysfunction that started it all was Samara.
Yeah.
I feel like the blame kind of goes to her parents, both of whom offed themselves. So maybe there is an element of, if you mess with stuff like that, this is what happens.
Or what happens when you have sex with a water demon. Am I right, ladies? I think there's a sense that Rachel, being a deeply independent woman, which I think we see very clearly in the remake, she has therefore raised an extremely independent, very intelligent child who doesn't really need her. In fact, there are several scenes which indicate he actually takes care of her. And the thing is that Samara desperately needs a parent. It's explored more in the terrible, terrible sequel they made. But, you know, as Rachel is cradling this decayed body in her arms at the bottom of this well, there you see that maternal instinct, and that seems to spark within her that maternal instinct towards her own son. She loves Aiden, but she's going through the motions, and then that seems to spark her actually wanting to be a parent to Aiden.
Another thing worth noting is that there's a conversation between Noah and Aiden that takes place in the car. That's kind of this awkward, you know, I don't think I'd be a good dad, so I'm not around very much. Would you want to be around more? Well, would you want me to be around more?
I've seen you. When I'm in the yard at school. You're there.
You wish I was around more?
No. You want to be around more?
Rachel and I were...
young. Mom's told me that story.
The thing is, I don't think I'd make a good father. Maybe it was because my own was such a disappointment.
Whereas Ryuji and Yoichi, there is absolutely nothing. When Ryuji goes to pick up Reiko, he waits in the car and stuff. There is zero contact. There is zero fathering. And there's very little regret or remorse for that, even when shit hits the fan.
And I think that's a trend in North American films where it is calling on a man to be required to step up. I mean, these are tropes in romantic comedies and dramas of a man needing to be needed in order to step up.
And a boy needing his father.
That's what The Shining was about, right?
No.
Oh. And another interesting thing we have to talk about in films that are kind of remade after very in short succession to each other is financial reasons. So the...
Holy shit!
What?
You see that?
No, what?
Oh. Nothing, I guess. I thought I saw. Sorry, go on. I'm okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought I saw
maybe
a shadow.
You did lose a lot of blood earlier.
Whew.
Okay. So Ringu actually cost about $1.2 million to make. It went on to gross $15.5 million in Japan alone. Now, Japan, though densely populated, is a very small place. And then within its first month alone, Ringu grossed $6.6 million in Japan, which again is huge. So it was very quickly a cultural phenomenon. Remakes were happening all over Asia. There are all kinds of different mythological takes on Sadako and that idea. Now, when DreamWorks picked up the rights to Ringu, they made their film for $40 million, which for a studio film is a relatively small budget. Not embarrassing, but it's not huge. Mm-hmm. It went on to gross, I think, like $150 million worldwide. It was a film that had a great staying power in the box office. Unintentionally or intentionally, people saw it and then went to their friends and said, holy shit, you need to see this film, which I think would have made Samara very happy. So to put this in perspective, in the first 2 weeks of The Ring, the remake's release in Japan, it grossed over $8 million. More than the original grossed in a month. It was a huge success there as well. People were flocking to it, apparently, not only out of curiosity, but also out of enjoyment. There's such an energy about that film that I think it is infectious.
Heyo.
So there is this huge kind of financial part to these kind of movies and why we do remakes. And of course, The Ring spawned so many other Asian film remakes. There was The Grudge, which I liked. There are also not so great ones like Pulse, the remake, The Eye, which is not good, and so a lot of okay ones like Dark Water, you know, but there wasn't that kind of sensation of The Ring.
Mm-hmm. I think The Ring also came out at a really interesting time for horror. It was really kind of a breath of fresh air. As we know, the 90s are kind of a big dark spot in the history of horror, and The Ring was something really new and novel. It was horror, but it was also widely accessible, as I said, to a really wide audience. Women were reacting well to it. Teens were reacting well to it.
And it's kind of, it did kind of bring back those gothic feelings. It was like almost like a haunted house movie. It was a ghost. It was unsettling. It was disturbing, but there's not a lot of gore. And I think it was a much more adult film. Not XXX, but just in a mature horror film, which it was really fun to watch. And it was fun to watch with an audience. So I think for me personally, I enjoy Gore Verbinski's The Ring more than the original. I still enjoy the original, but to be honest, I kind of love how dramatic it is, how almost grand guignol it is. It's a very fun film to watch. It's a film that I love watching with people, and I love watching it by myself. So it's a pretty, I think that's pretty rare. I think that the subtlety of the Japanese version, we wouldn't have the greatness of the remake if we hadn't had a subtle, controlled, contained film before it. And I would actually recommend, I did this last night, if you have the time and are nerds like me and Andrea, if you can back-to-back these films, it's actually a pretty interesting watch, and I highly recommend that. So listen to the podcast, watch those two back-to-back, and then listen to the podcast again, and you'll be fine.
I have to agree. I feel like The Ring is a very rare circumstance of a remake, a cross-cultural remake that improves upon the original. I think it spoke to American audiences without condescending to them. And if you can't guess, I'm alluding to Let Me In and Let the Right One In, which is just kind of a play per play that almost makes you ashamed to live in the West to have had that happen to the original source material. Yeah, I thought it was inventive and it built upon the original in meaningful ways, which I really, really appreciate. And I give it a thumbs up. If you haven't seen it in a while, go back to it. It's pretty all right. There's a lot of themes and stuff going on. There's a lot to talk about. I mean, we kind of scratched the surface here, but we'll be posting articles because, I mean, we were looking at articles on the uncanny. There was an article reprinted out of the 49th Parallel, which is an academic journal that's just kind of, it talks about how the films pit the fear of nature against the fear of technology, and the American version emphasizes the fear of technology because as a culture, we kind of repress nature. So there's a lot to be found in there. There's my own little analysis about the family. Lots to be found if you have the inclination to look, so please do.
So, from Andrea and myself, thank you for listening to another episode of the Faculty of Horror. This episode was lubricated by Sapporo Beer. We'd also like to mention, if you missed it, I was a guest on Rewatchability a few weeks ago, a guest on the episode about Drop Dead Fred. That was really fun. So if you want to hear more, you can go listen to them. They're great. I highly recommend subscribing and listening to them. And Andrea, were you on a podcast?
I almost was. You might notice that while we're podcasting, there's this program open on the screen and you can see the levels going. That's how I know the mic knows we're talking.
Yeah. So I think Andrea kind of talked about Nightmare on Elm Street 4, Time Bandits. If you have a good audio setup, I think you can hear her. It was great because when I was listening to it, it sounds like you were outside, like yelling through a window.
Yeah, your dream come true.
Yeah. So thank you to Modern Superior, our friends on that network. Hopefully we're still friends after those comments. To Rue Morgue Podcast, Stuart Feedback, Andrew's our guest on our last episode, for mentioning us and being a supporter of us. And we really, really appreciate it. And yeah, Andrea, thank you for another great episode.
Yeah, no problem. Good times. Good times.
All right. So from myself and Andrea, office hours are closed. That was a really good episode.
Yeah, that was good. That was good.
I felt good. I got some stuff I got to do.
All right. Well, until next time, I guess I'll give you a shout. We'll.
I'm sorry. I gotta run.
It's okay.
I think you're great.
Yeah. I think you're great too. Okay, bye.
Bye.
What the? Off. Get the remote over there.